From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm your moderator, David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist, and joining us this week, Laura Mechler, staff writer for The Wall Street Journal. And here are the issues. More than a week after Hurricane Maria struck the U.S. territory of Puerto Rico on September the 20th, millions on the island remain without electric power or running water, raising questions about the slow response of President Donald Trump's federal government. Meanwhile, domestic woes have kept Mr. Trump busy. Some were of his own making when he picked a fight with top American footballers over political protests. Some involved internal battles within Mr. Trump's Republican Party, threatening their legislative agenda. The Trump administration unveiled its latest attempt at a ban on travelers from high-risk countries. The new ban adds some non-Muslim nations to the list, notably Venezuela and North Korea, but stirred controversy by adding Chad, an ally, in the fight against terrorism. Voters in the autonomous Kurdistan region of Iraq voted overwhelmingly for independence, triggering a partial shutdown of Kurdish airspace by the government in Baghdad. And in Saudi Arabia, women are to be allowed to drive from next summer, ending a restriction that has long drawn global attention. So it's been a very strange week in terms of the news from Puerto Rico, Laura, because it's sort of a domestic story, and you can see the big news organizations sort of putting it on the front page and reminding people that these are American citizens with American passports. When you remember back to the other hurricanes we've had this hurricane season that hit places like Florida or Houston in Texas, sitting here in America, does it feel as if Americans are as concerned about Puerto Rico? Does it feel as close to home?
You know, it doesn't. And I think that that's due to a variety of factors. I think that, first of all, sadly, I'm not sure that most Americans know or all Americans know that those people who live there are American citizens. Obviously, they don't have the full rights of Americans, but they are part of this country. And I think that Puerto Rico is maybe sometimes viewed the way that people might view, say, the Dominican Republic or another, you know, sort of close by, but third world country that is, you know, there's always problems somewhere, you know, that sort of thing, as opposed to, well, this problem is our problem. I think there's also an issue with a little bit of hurricane fatigue. You know, there was Houston, which was devastating. Then people were very geared up for Irma hitting Florida, which wasn't quite as bad as people thought, but there was a lot of attention to it. And I wonder, I mean, this isn't based on anything but a guess, that if people are just sort of like, oh, well, didn't, you know, there's problems everywhere, you know, and not enough focus of the mind on what is truly a disaster. And a lot of criticism of President Trump for not focusing on this right away. To whatever extent that was true, I think that they're working to rectify it and realizing that this is something they need to be on top of, because it truly is a horrifying situation.
So before we explore the political argument, which, as you say, is really getting quite sort of heated now, let's just look at some of the basics of just how bad the situation has been for this first several days after the hurricane. And to remind listeners, Puerto Rico is, I guess, effectively the closest America has to a big colony. It's not a state, it's a territory, but it's basically a colony. But America doesn't like to admit that it has colonies, but that's kind of legally what it is. What are the big issues that we can see in terms of, you know, how abnormal is life in Puerto Rico, you know, 8-9 days after this hurricane hit?
Well, I think that if you don't have electricity and you don't have access to running water and you don't, people are pulling over to one spot on the side of the road to get a cell phone signal, I think it's fair to say that your life is nothing like what you would expect. So, you know, when you look at the sort of hierarchy of needs that we all have and what we deal with on a day-to-day basis, they're at square one. That said, medicine as well. I mean, we're not talking about extraordinary stuff. We're talking about people who have diabetes or heart disease.
And you're seeing sort of really shocking reports about, you know, there are generators in hospitals with backup power, but actually fuel for those generators is not arriving. There's an argument that there's actually quite a lot of water and fuel and supplies that has arrived on the dockside in the capital of Puerto Rico, but it's the roads are out, the electricity is out, a lot of the truck drivers have lost their own homes, they can't get to work. And so is there a sense that this could become like Hurricane Katrina was? If listeners remember when George W. Bush was president and you had that terrible flooding in the mostly poor, mostly black center of New Orleans, and that became a big issue, the question of kind of competence of his government at that time. Here in Washington, are people looking at Puerto Rico and saying this could be Donald Trump's Hurricane Katrina?
I think there's a little bit of that. I think that there is the potential that that could happen and that there is some talk along those lines. I think it's probably not going to be that dramatic, partly because there's so much happening in Washington and there's just so much craziness day in, day out, that I don't know that we have the capacity to focus on one story, as tragic as it is, for more than about an hour. That's just, I think, sad but true. And that's why I think you've seen President Trump, you know, said he's going to go to Puerto Rico. And I think the reason why he's doing that is because he's realizing this does have, or at least people around him are realizing that he does need to focus.
Now, here in Washington, we should only ever judge things by their moral importance or their human importance. But unfortunately, you know, the sea that we swim in is also one of electoral calculation and political calculations. So if you are taking an absolutely cynical Washington political calculation kind of look at this, why is it not a bigger deal that, you know, there are 5 million Puerto Ricans who live in the United States? They have the vote. An increasing number of them live in Florida, which is one of the most important battleground states at election time. And yet, Donald Trump, the accusation from his critics is that he's been picking all kinds of other fights, he hasn't been paying attention. What's that about? And is there any fairness to the charge that this reflects something bigger about Donald Trump, which is that he's really struggling to be the president for all Americans, that for him, his focus is again and again on those Americans who voted for him last year, and that's who he spends almost all his time kind of worrying about and talking to. Is there any justice to that charge, do you think?
Well, I mean, I think you answered your first question with your second question. I mean, these aren't, if you're looking at it from pure political terms, these aren't his voters. I think there's no question that since Donald Trump has taken office, that he has been an incredibly divisive figure, and that's played out on many, many fronts. You mentioned in the intro the controversy about the National Football League and the protests that some of the players are doing, and we can talk about that in a bit. But there's no doubt that he has been a divisive figure. Now, is he ignoring these people because they aren't his people? Well, I think that is, you know, who knows?
And who knows what's in his heart?
Who knows what's in his heart? I'm not going to pretend that I know. And I'm not even going to, you know, pretend that the people who work for him in his administration have some sort of political calculation. I don't think that that's what's going on. The question is, when this happens, do you say, this is the most important thing for me to think about, and I'm going to forget all the noise on the side and all of this and focus on this, or do you get distracted? And I think that I don't know that this is necessarily kind of a racist thing, that this is, he doesn't care about these people.
No, not so much that. That we've seen Donald Trump distracting attention all week with this issue about the American football players, which looked at the time like an attempt to reassure his base that he wasn't going soft on, you know, the kind of issues that excite them. And that just kind of left him very little bandwidth to pay attention to Puerto Rico, because those just aren't his voters.
Forget about it. Not even Puerto Rico, but also, I mean, his health care bill was collapsing at the exact same moment when he's picking a fight with the NFL, the National Football League. Does that make sense? I don't think that you can apply normal calculations of what makes sense to this presidency. There's so much that doesn't make sense.
So let's look into those domestic woes that have, kept him very busy for the whole week. So one was of his own making. He chose to pick this fight, this very symbolic fight about, you know, patriotism and the flag and the anthem and stuff with the Football League, which was clearly designed to appeal to his kind of core vote. But there are other domestic woes involving the fact that although Donald Trump is a Republican, and although Congress is controlled by the Republicans, and normally that means they would get lots of stuff done, he's not had a great week in terms of getting stuff done and even getting his the people who he has officially endorsed to be the next candidate for a big Senate seat down in Alabama. Tell us, before we go to the break, about the week that the Republicans have had in Washington.
Right. So we started out with the collapse of the health care bill. Now, you have to understand, this has been a promise in the making for 7 years. Republicans have promised to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, sometimes called Obamacare. This has been their cause célèbre, the animating feature of election after election. And then now they've had the chance to do it time after time, and they cannot agree on what the replacement should be. And that happened yet again with this last effort. It died a death at the beginning of this week, although I think in some ways this is kind of a zombie bill. It is never quite dead. It will come back again, I feel sure. But the reason why they can't do it is because they don't know what they want to do as a party. They don't have something that they can all agree on. And unlike the Democrats in 2009, when they pushed something through with only Democratic votes, they were unified at the basic direction they wanted to go. Republicans are not. And how this comes back to President Trump is that it is his job as leader of the party to set out a vision and pull people together generally around it. He has failed to do that.
And just on this health bill, before we go to the break, is there a problem that Donald Trump, I mean, all of us who covered the campaign last year, I watched Donald Trump on sort of, you know, multiple rally platforms telling his voters a story about how the health law that Barack Obama had implemented was a disaster that was costing them money, that was killing them, it was awful. He was going to replace it with something that covered more people, that was more generous and cost less money. And that kind of that triangle of promises, any health economist you spoke to said, is just nonsense, it can't happen. Is there just a sense that this is one of his promises that is just catching up with him?
Yes, 100%. And not only that, he laid out an extremely intellectually dishonest, politically dishonest thing to say. But even beyond that, this is such a complicated issue. To even get a little bits and pieces of that promise are hard.
So he's smacking right up against reality. And we'll have more in just a minute. This is Issues in the News, coming to you on The Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, David Rennie, Washington bureau chief for The Economist, and Laura Mechler, staff writer for The Wall Street Journal, joins me today. This is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. Listen to it, and then tell us what you think by taking a short survey on our Facebook page, Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. So the Trump administration, almost one of the very first things that it did when it first came to power was to put out a travel ban, which sort of flowed out of promises that Donald Trump made on the campaign trail to have a Muslim ban, which then raised a lot of legal suspicions that this travel ban was kind of a Muslim ban. Laura, tell us what's different about this latest attempt at a travel ban, which identifies high-risk countries. How does it get around that charge that this is just a Muslim ban in disguise?
Well, there's two main reasons why this is different. And truthfully, this version of the travel ban is much more thought out than the first one was by several miles. But whether it will stand up to constitutional scrutiny is another question. But first of all, what it did was it actually set out a set of criteria that all countries in the world had to meet. So they did a review of every country on the planet to see, are they doing what the United States wants them to do in terms of helping us vet their citizens? So that includes things like issue electronic passports, sharing information that they have about known terrorists and criminals, that sort of thing. The countries that failed that test, then they engaged with them, tried to essentially bully them into doing those things by saying, if you don't, you may be barred from traveling to the U.S. altogether. Then they sort of put a foreign policy lens over the whole thing. And certain countries, even though they failed the test, like Iraq, were allowed to continue traveling here anyway. Sudan actually passed the test. They were originally banned, and then they actually are doing what we asked of them. So Somalia, on the other hand, is not really doing what we asked or is doing what we asked of them. But we still think that they're too much of a risk. So they're on the list. So this test that was applied is a little squishy, shall we say. But they did have some objective criteria. And the second thing they did was that they did add a couple non-Muslim countries to the list, North Korea and Venezuela. However, you know, some of these things are not like the other. Venezuela's, quote, travel ban only applies to senior government officials and their families.
So it's sort of a sanction, really. It's
more
a political
of a
sanction,
yes, more in
a terrorism thing.
Exactly. Being like exactly lumped in with the others who are actually banned. Their citizens are banned from coming here under many circumstances. North Korea sends very few people to this country, of course, but because they're not allowed to come. So that is a bit symbolic also.
And very briefly, there's been a controversy around Chad, which is on the banned list and which is not the world's greatest example of human rights, but has some supporters within the counterterrorism world in Washington. Why?
Well, because they're a partner in our efforts to counter terrorist extreme groups in the area. And that was noted in the proclamation. It was noted that they are a partner. However, they did not get one of the exceptions. And they said, you know, that we still don't have the information we need to vet the citizens of Chad. And therefore, they have restrictions as well. So quite a controversial decision there.
Let's turn our gaze to other parts of the world and two places in the world, regions of other countries which want to break away. So we have the Kurdish region of Iraq actually holding a vote massively to break away from Iraq. We have the Catalan region of Spain, where a lot of people may, you know, very famous cities like Barcelona, wealthy, sophisticated region of Spain, trying to hold a vote over the weekend against the wishes of the Spanish government, which is sending in police from other bits of Spain to kind of grab ballot boxes and shut off public schools where they're planning votes. That's very dramatic stuff. We have a president, Donald Trump, who was elected on a very kind of populist nationalist program, who supported Brexit, said that breaking away from the European Union was a fantastic thing, saw his own election as kind of one of these kind of expressions of rage that was going to sweep the world. Some of Trump's advisors, like Steve Bannon, very keen on this idea of a kind of wave of rage around the world. And yet, actually, the Americans have said, stick with the status quo. The Kurds don't break away. They've sided with the Iraqi government. In Spain, Donald Trump sat next to the Prime Minister of Spain in the White House and said he didn't support the Catalan breakaway. What's going on? Why does Donald Trump support nationalist rage, but not in the case of Kurdistan and not in the case of Catalonia?
And first, I'll just add that in the case of Spain, even though he contradicted his own State Department in saying that the State Department had said that we were neutral on the matter, and then he came out and sided with Spain. I think you're looking for intellectual consistency where you may not find it. And if you continue doing that for the remainder of the Trump administration, you may find yourself frustrated time and again. He was not elected on a wave of views about what Catalonia should do. Most of his supporters have no idea what Catalonia is, think it might be maybe an option for dinner at an Italian restaurant. This is not what he's about. He did not run for office because he has an appreciation of the subtleties of the different divisions within Iraq. I don't think it may sound inconsistent. I don't think he views it as inconsistent at all.
And tell us about Kurdistan. So this is a region where Americans have been, you know, occasionally seeming to fan the flames of Kurdish kind of ambitions for their own country, going back to the very first Gulf War and the way that the Kurds were encouraged to rise up and then America pulled back. Why, time and again, do Kurds who are, you know, tend to be pro-American, tend to help the Americans fight their enemies? What are the geopolitical forces that mean that for kind of reasons of realpolitik, America time and again actually says to the Kurds, you know what, we don't support you getting your own country?
Well, I mean, isn't Iraq enough of a mess as it is? I think that would be the basic argument. You know, right now we have a situation where, you know, ISIS is all over the country. We're trying to support the Iraqi government as they control the terror threat inside Iraq. So the idea that then the Iraqi government would also have to deal with a breakaway republic is perhaps a bridge too far for any government.
And across the border in Turkey, you have a lot of Kurds, and the Turkish government, though very problematic, ally.
Exactly. And they're, the Turkish government is furious about this referendum. And Iran is also unhappy about it. They're also concerned in similar ways. So I think the bottom line is that this is a volatile region with a lot of troubles already. We don't need to add another.
And the relationship with Turkey is also, I mean, Turkey is a NATO ally. And although very problematic for a long time, we've seen Donald Trump actually quite close to the strongman president of Turkey, Recep Tayyip Erdogan.
Yes.
And supporting him sometimes when others were kind of concerned about his human rights. That's basically about the fight with ISIS? What's going on? Why are we turning a blind eye to the Turks and certainly listening to Turkish concerns about Kurdish separatism?
Well, I think part of it has to do with trying to maintain stability in the region. Part of it has to do that Donald Trump seems to be drawn to strong leaders, even if they use their strength in ways that some of us, you know, may not think is a great idea.
And is there a sense that Donald Trump's supporters, when they look at the Middle East, which is not necessarily a place they enjoy reading about and hearing about, when he says that basically the priority has to be destroying ISIS and keeping America safe, that's what his supporters want to hear? That he understands the American people pretty well?
I don't think that Donald Trump supporters, or for that matter, most Hillary Clinton supporters, are sitting around thinking about the independence and aspirations of the Kurdish people. I mean, these are subtleties of foreign policy that experts view, rightfully so, as incredibly important to the region and to global stability. But for your average American, this isn't even on their radar. So I don't think that from a political point of view, Trump has anything to worry about.
And just finally on this question of Donald Trump not siding with kind of populist nationalist anger, and as you're quite right to say that you end up kind of in despair if you try and find necessarily a kind of coherent ideology to this. Is there a sense that Donald Trump, who ran as such an unconventional candidate in so many ways, but including on foreign policy, saying things about Russia that were friendlier than we'd ever heard from certainly a Republican, saying things about America first and, you know, pulling back from the world. Now that we're, you know, at the 8-9 month mark of his presidency, is there a sense that actually he is looking a little bit more conventional when it comes to the decisions that he makes? Maybe not every piece of rhetoric, so that he may stand in the UN and talk about the North Korean leader as Rocket Man, and that doesn't sound like a normal US president. But actually, if you look at these issues, like, does he inflame the Kurdish separatist cause, or does he inflame the kind of breakup of Spain? Actually, it looks as though when the generals and the experts explain it to him, he's more conventional than
I think. That's exactly right. You even saw it on the Paris Climate Accord, where he said he was pulling out, and then there are signs that, well, maybe he's going to try to stay in. I think that he talks a tough game, and I don't think he's by any means a conventional U.S. leader, but I think he has definitely been pulled more in that direction, and I definitely agree with your analysis that it's the generals that he's put in charge who do understand the world who are influencing him quite a bit.
Let's turn finally to a piece of good news, I think, for women and for everyone, I think, in Saudi Arabia. You've had for a very long time this very wealthy country where women have increasingly been becoming kind of, you know, allowed to own businesses and some become very successful, but they weren't allowed to drive. And that has been a kind of symbolic thing that people kept coming, you know, back to and saying, you know, how can you call yourself a normal country when you don't even let women drive? That's finally going to change.
And I would like to welcome Saudi Arabia to the 20th century. I hope they enjoy it there. And perhaps someday they'll join us here in the 21st. I mean, it was an absurd restriction, obviously. And, you know, you and I were discussing this off air. I think that it's insulting both to women and to men. The argument that they give is that, you know, men can't handle it. They'll attack women if they see them in a vulnerable position. If a woman drives up next to them and a man glances over and sees a woman in the car, well, will he be able to focus on the road? I mean, seriously?
Yeah, no, you're right. I love your point about welcome to the 20th century, because, of course, if autonomous cars, driverless cars, come along anytime soon, you know, the poor Saudi women, they'll get like 3 years behind the wheel.
That's what I was going to say.
It's going to be a Google car. So,
exactly. Welcome to driving, just as driving becomes passé.
Yes, but it's been. I mean, let's salute the bravery of some Saudi women who have been taking cell phone video of themselves driving.
Absolutely.
Behind the wheel and taking a big risk. I mean, they could get into trouble for that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I do salute them. Obviously, the rest of us, people living in other countries with much more liberal views on these things, have take this for granted. You know, I learned to drive when I was 16. I'm quite sure that a fully grown Saudi adult woman is much more capable than the 16-year-old teenagers we have on the road here.
Well, a piece of good news from Saudi Arabia, which frankly is a country that could do with some good news. And that's all the time we have. I was talking today to Laura Meckler, staff writer for The Wall Street Journal. This programme was produced by Rebecca Ward. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. And I'm David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist. Thanks for listening.